So the first reading is from Psalm 132. Remember, O Lord, in David's favor, all the hardships he endured, how he swore to the Lord and vowed to the Mighty One of Jacob, I will not enter my house or get into my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the Mighty One of Jacob. Behold, we heard of it in Ephrata. We found it in the fields of Jar. Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. Let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and let your saints shout for joy. For the sake of your servant David, do not turn away the face of your anointed one. The Lord swore to David a sure oath, from which he will not turn back. One of the sons of your body I will set on your throne. If your sons keep my covenant and my testimonies that I shall teach them, their sons also forever shall sit on your throne. For the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his dwelling place. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. I will abundantly bless her provisions. I will satisfy her poor with bread. Her priests I will clothe with salvation, and her saints will shout for joy. There I will make a horn to sprout for David. I have prepared a lamp for my anointed. His enemies I will clothe with shame, but on him his crown will shine. This is the word of the Lord.
For those of you who weren't around in the 80s, that was Boney M. singing Psalm 137. Though if you read Psalm 137 carefully, you realize the mood is actually rather different. She sounded, whoever it was singing, sounded quite cheerful. Actually, the mood of the song is very dark and tragic. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? Now, could anybody express what do you think was the contrast between Psalm 132 and Psalm 137, as much as you could hear of it? I've mentioned one contrast there should be, a difference between a great song of psalm of praise, Psalm 132, and what is called a lament, a klagelied, which is Psalm 137. The first one is actually glorying in the wonders of the temple on Mount Zion, and Psalm 137 is actually mourning for the temple, which doesn't exist anymore at the time they're singing in exile in Babylon. And that's the third difference, is the location. The first one, we imagine them singing it at the temple in Jerusalem. The second one, they're by the rivers of Babylon, where they would rather be in Jerusalem. They've been deported. Jerusalem fell to the Babylonian armies, finally, in 586 BC. The city was destroyed, and the temple was destroyed, and most of the population was sent into exile. And so the Psalm 137 is written by one of those exiles grieving for Jerusalem. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How can we be cheerful when we're so far away from the Lord? So in a way, there's more than a contrast between those two psalms. There's actually something of a contradiction. How can this place where heaven and earth meet be destroyed by pagan armies? How can it be a place where the Lord dwells, and yet a place where the forces of evil have set up their headquarters? Surely the Lord could not have allowed that to happen. So why did it happen? So my first sort of section, sorry, they're not on, the sections are not on the Bema, but I'll try and headline them for you. My first heading is how they have ended up where they are. How they've ended up where they are. It's been a long, steady decline. We heard last week where the decline began. It actually began at the high point of Israel's life as a nation during the reign of Solomon. You may remember how there'd been that turning point at the beginning of the book of Samuel when God begins to speak to his people again, speaking through Samuel. And that is the turning point. Things are going up. And all the way through the reign of the kings that Samuel anoints, all the way to Solomon, things are going uphill. And then there's a turning point at that point when they are at the peak of their power, a military, a political, economic power and prosperity. At that point, we read these verses from 1 Kings. I'll read them to you. Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. But in a way, it may have been his wisdom that was his undoing. He may have fallen into the trap of trusting in the gift and not in the one who had given him the gift. God had made him wise. Wise enough to realize that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, as he put it. But perhaps he didn't notice when he himself began to fear the Lord less and less, and therefore become less wise. One can imagine he began to think he could twist the rules a bit. Well, the Lord said had no foreign wives, but hey, I'm the king and I'm the wisest man of my day. Why not be tied down by a few rules? And as soon as that gift of wisdom was detached, getrennt, from a living relationship with the giver of the wisdom, as soon as he began to take the gift for granted, the rot set in. Again, from Kings, some verses we heard last week. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. So in his own lifetime, the seeds of decline were sown. That was, if you like, the turning point. The seeds were sown for civil war, which began after his death. Before long, the kingdom is divided in two, the 10 northern tribes, later called the kingdom of Samaria, the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, later known as Judah. And generation by generation, king by king, things get worse and worse. In 722 BC, the lights go out in that northern kingdom, and they never went on again. They were defeated by the reigning superpower, the Assyrians. They were scattered to the four winds, and migrants were brought in from other parts of the empire to live there and mix in with the few remaining Israelites in the land, but many of them were also deported. It became a mixed place with mixed religion. Worship of the Lord continued, but in a very superstitious way. And from that we have the Samaritans who were around at the time of Jesus. The southern kingdom struggled on through ups and downs for another 150 years or so. And there were a few ups along the way, a few sort of blips in the downward chart where they had kings who sought to renew the nation, people like Josiah. But overall, the trajectory was down, heading for the Keller, as they say. And where they ended up was actually worse than in the cellar. A new superpower arises and begins to throw its weight around, the Babylonian Empire this time. And at times, like many good empires, like the good old British Empire, They allowed a measure of self-rule. You know, we'll let you rule yourselves as long as you do what we want the whole time. And that's what they did to Judah after 597 BC. They conquered Judah and they said, okay, your own king can carry on ruling it, self-rule. But then Zedekiah decided to rebel against Babylon, and that was it. The Babylonians invaded and did a proper job this time in 586 BC, so 13 years later, after 13 years of self-rule, they razed it to the ground. That's the English word R-A-Z-E, which means den Boden gleich gemacht, or something like that. They literally destroyed everything, broke down all the walls and the temple. And Beutekunst, I gather, is rather topical at the moment after Angela Merkel's visit to Russia. Well, they took quite a lot of Beutekunst with them from the Jerusalem temple to Babylon. They also took the majority of the population, certainly the elite, people like Daniel, but also people like Ezekiel, who was a prophet during the exile, or people like the writer of Psalm 137. And like him, these exiles couldn't believe the extent of disaster that had come upon them. And they pour out their grief and anguish in various parts of the scriptures. That's how they've ended up where they are. And in order to understand what we read in Lamentations, it's perhaps helpful to define a little more carefully, who is the they who've ended up in exile? Well, obviously, they're all members of the people of Israel. But I think they must be in two different places spiritually, two different groups. I would suggest you've got a mixture of the rebellious and the righteous. The rebellious, those are people who were personally at fault. If you like, they deserve to be where they are because they had rebelled against God, and therefore God has acted in judgment. But there are also among them those who are not personally at fault because they carried on faithfully serving and worshipping Yahweh throughout the time of the nation's rebellion. But if you like, they're corporately at fault. They're part of the nation that is sinful, part of the sinful house of Israel. And both these groups will have been there in the exile. And that's worth bearing in mind when we think through what it means for us. If we perhaps think of the question, when might we find ourselves in a similar situation? If we experience what seems to be God's judgment in some way, it may be due to personal sin. It may also be due to not personal sin, but the corporate sin of the particular group of God's people, the church, Gemeinde or Kirche, to which we belong. And here are two groups who are not included under those in a similar situation. And that's also important to see, I think. They're not in a Job-like situation. Job was a righteous man who was tested by God. He experienced a tragedy which wasn't tied to any particular sin by him or any particular sin by his people. It was a tragedy of living in a fallen world, I guess we might say, along the lines of what we thought about earlier of Max and so on. That's a different situation to the deserved judgment we read of here. And it's not talking about people who are not yet believers. It's his own people that God is holding to account here. Those who do know the truth, those who have heard his word, but have chosen to ignore it or to reject it. So if you're still in the position of being a seeker, seeking after God, in a sense, this doesn't speak to you directly, this exile experience. But you might be in this situation if you are what we might call a shameless believer at this present time. Someone who signed up as a follower of Jesus Christ, but isn't actually that bothered about the commitments that go with it. Not that bothered about the lifestyle that is pleasing to God and actually good for us as well. The prophet Jeremiah, who was around at the time, and probably wrote the Lamentations, describes such people as backsliders. In fact, this version doesn't call them backsliders. It's in the NIV. It's translated as backsliders, those who slide away from the truth of God. But you could also call them backturners, because a couple of times he talks about the people turning their backs on God. 2:19, I think, was the one I'm looking for. The Lord says, they, through Jeremiah, they have turned their back to me and not their face. They don't act out of ignorance. They're deliberate in their sin. We may think of Jesus' words about those to whom much is given, much is expected. God holds his people accountable. If you're in that situation now of deliberately turning away from God for a season and you think, well, I'll only do it for a while, you need to listen carefully. So we turn to the second heading, how they feel about where they are. The book of Lamentations is actually where I'm basing myself. And there isn't really much time to show you much from this book. It's page 828, 829, if you want to turn to it. I would encourage you, perhaps, in the light of the sermon, you might want to read through this book this coming week in your own times of devotion, maybe a chapter a day. That's five chapters. It's rather gloomy reading. So you could finish with Psalm 132 again, remembering God's desire to be among his people. The book's been described as an A to Z of grief. Literally an A to Z, because each chapter, well, most chapters, are what they call an acrostic. That is, each verse begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So an A to Z of grief. The writer feels desolate and alone. For these things I weep. My eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. Full of remorse and penitence, look, O Lord, for I am in distress. My stomach churns, my heart is wrung within me, because I have been very rebellious. In the street the sword bereaves, in the house it is like death. And probably the I there is a collective I, in a sense, the I as the nation speaking, Zion speaking, I have been rebellious. And they're aware that all the disaster that has happened, inexplicable as it is from the Lord's hand. It's all deserved. 1 verse 5. Because the Lord has afflicted Zion for the multitude of her transgressions. And verse 12. The sorrow which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his first anger. And verse 18. The Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. So they're very conscious of this great contrast, the before and after. From the privilege of being God's special people, having him dwelling in their midst, they become a laughingstock for the nations and mocked. 2:15. All who pass along the way clap their hands at you. They hiss and wag their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of all the earth? All your enemies rail against you. They hiss, they gnash their teeth, they cry, we have swallowed her. Ah, this is the day we longed for. Now we have it, we see it. And I guess, in a way, one of the fundamental questions they're trying to answer in the exile, as they look ahead, is this. Is this a turning point? Or is this the end point of their life as God's people? You know, some of you, that that's the theme of our series, Turning Points in the History of Israel. Well, is this a turning point? Is it an end point? I've already mentioned that for the northern kingdom, the 10 northern tribes, it was the end point. They have never returned as the 10 tribes. So what about the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin? The outlook is bleak at the time. There's no chance of a return to Zion except perhaps on a visitor's visa for a few weeks. Is there a future for them as God's people? And the writer is close to losing hope. Listen to bits of chapter 3, verse 1 first. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. He has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me he turns his hand again and again the whole day long. And verse 16, he has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance has perished, and so has my hope from the Lord. But just as that, just at that lowest point when hope seems to have died, there are a few sparks, a few gleams of a new dawn. He remembers who it is that he's talking about. And for a moment, the lament is not just about God, but this lament is addressed to God. 19, remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. And then come the verses for which this book is probably the most famous. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. While there's God, there's hope. You may remember what I said a few weeks ago about mercy and grace. Mercy is when God doesn't give us what we do deserve, withholds an element of judgment. Grace is God giving us what we do not deserve, pouring out undeserved love and riches on us. It's hard for them to reconcile what they're going through with what they know of the Lord's mercy and his grace from the past. But there was enough of that experience in the past to cling on to in hope that there will still be a future. And that's a confusion, that uncertainty remains right to the end of the book. It's not a book that ends on a triumphant note, having overcome darkness and despair. It closes with the same mixture, confused mixture of emotions and questions. Let me read the last verses. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. For this our heart has become sick. For these things our eyes have grown dim. For Mount Zion, which lies desolate, jackals, wild animals, prowl over it. But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations. So why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us for so many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. Unless you have utterly rejected us, and you remain exceedingly angry with us. So the question's left open. Will the Lord intervene or not? Will it prove to be a turning point for the better or will this prove to be the end point for the chosen people of God? And I don't actually want to go on and give you the answer this morning. It's good for us at times to stay with the emotions of those who have gone before us in the faith, in a sense, experience and share in their anguish. Because any of us who are among God's people may experience something like this on an individual level. We may experience. You may even be able to think of having experienced a time when you turned your back on God and you found that he had in some sense turned his back on you and allowed you to live with the consequences of your decision. And you may have then begun to wonder, is there any way back? Have I blown it for good? All we can cling on to in times like that is what we do know of God, what we've experienced of him, that his mercy is new every morning, even to those of his people who've turned their backs on him. We may experience it on a corporate level, not being backsliders ourselves, but experiencing life in a Gemeinde or a church which is backsliding away from the Lord. No Christian is an island entire of himself. We're all connected to one another and to Christ. We can't always escape the consequences of what is going on in our denomination or the wider body of Christ. And we may be caught up in times when it seems the Lord has abandoned his church where she has been faithless, which may mean an experience not so very far removed from exile. It may be that our generation will experience something of that in the West. And our only hope at times like that is God himself and what we know of him. And there we do have some advantage over the people of that day. We know more of God because we live the other side of his coming to earth. We know of his coming to earth not just in a spiritual and a symbolic way to dwell in the temple at Jerusalem in a way that no one could approach safely because God is holy. We know of the God who came into this world in person to live amongst us so that we could see and touch and feel and hear and speak to him. So we have more reasons to trust in God's goodness and mercy because we know the God that has tabernacled amongst us, as John puts it. And we do actually know that there was life beyond the exile. And I'm not really talking about the physical return to Israel, but spiritual life after the exile. There'll be more about that next week, so I won't steal next week's preacher's thunder. But we do have some understanding of how it is possible for there to be renewed life after sin and judgment. And the place I want to leave you is actually in some verses in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31. You may know these verses quite well already. Page 798. He speaks here, prophesies, what we now can see is the work of the Holy Spirit, who wasn't working back then in the same way that he works today, dwelling in the hearts of God's believers. This is what we believe is possible through Jesus Christ today. So I'll begin at I'll read it from 31. It's important. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, even though I was their husband, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. May God grant that we live in days where that becomes more and more of a reality amongst all God's people, amongst all those who follow Jesus Christ and inherit this promise. And may God guard us against being those people who begin to experience this gift, this treasure of the Holy Spirit dwelling within us, and then seek to walk away from it. May God guard us from that future. And if we do drift from him, may we experience him drawing us back and restoring us, because his steadfast love never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning.